The Guardian.
This is the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Hello to all of you and thank you for downloading. It was the final round of games in the Champions League group stages. It was a good night for the English clubs, so there's plenty to discuss there. We look ahead to the weekend's Premier League fixtures and finish on the holy trinity of Football Weekly topics, Clattenburg Chequertrade Championship. Hi there, my name's Ellis James. I'm in the hot seat today as there's no Max Rushton. Unfortunately, I don't have all the details. He was hosting a corporate fun day for Synatogen and he pulled his hamstring in a ball pool. So, you know, best wishes to Max. He was larking around during a trust exercise and it went horribly wrong. Chatted to him. Even though he didn't do the zip wire, his agent reckons he can get half the fee, so he's quite happy. Anyway, here we go. Punditry pays the rent. Archie Rind Tut does his share. How are you, Archie?
I'm very well. Thank you very much.
I'm going to open the pod with a little bit of classic commentary for everyone. So do look forward to this. Interesting. Very interesting. Look at his face. Just look at his face. It's Andy Brussel.
Hello, Ellis. How are you, Andy?
I'm good.
Okay, very good. And he's my favourite sports writer and yours. He's known here at Guardian HQ as the Hugh McIlvany for the Snapchat generation. It's Barry Glendenning. How are you, Baz?
I'm very well, Ellis. Yes,
you're the Norman Mailer for the Hootie and the Blowfish generation.
Oh, my God. I see that you've sitting in big chair there, you've adopted the classic kind of Jig Humphrey sprawl.
Yeah,
where you're reclining so far back, the back of your head is practically touching the floor and your legs are akimbo. There's a lot of man spreading. You're like a spider with swollen testicles.
It's a power play. I'm showing everyone, because I see that obviously Max isn't with us because of his horrendous hamstring injury. But for me, this is a shop window. You know, I'm going to knife him in the back.
Speaking of which, you know, Jake Humphrey has got a Nando's black card. Do you have a Nando's black card yet?
No, I don't.
This is the first step towards that, Ellis.
I'd prefer the Pizza Express black card. Personally, okay. If there was one on offer. How did he get his black card? Do you know?
I don't know, but apparently he's very generous in sharing it around.
Is he?
Yeah.
Well.
He's not a huge fan of Nando's himself. So I've heard.
I had no firm opinion on Jake Humphreys prior to this conversation, but now I think he's up there with Mother Teresa. What an absolute gentleman.
What's a Nando's black card?
You go into Nando's with all your mates and you eat whatever you want for free.
Wow.
Including refillable Diet Coke. It doesn't get any better than that. But, well, let's start with...
I know somebody not a million miles away co-producing this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Who went to Nando's, just asked for a glass of water, and then filled the glass with stolen, what can only be described as stolen Diet Coke. Isn't that right, producer Melissa? No, everyone doesn't do that.
That is absolutely horrendous behaviour. Well, I think we should get cracking on that rather sour note. Five English teams with the last 16 of the Champions League for the first time. So let's start at Anfield. Liverpool securing top spot in style. 7-0 winners against Spartak Moscow. And in doing so, they set a record number of goals from an English team in the group stages. 23 goals, beating United's record, who scored 20 in 1999. So let's start with you, Archie. Did you watch the game?
I watched the first 20 minutes or so until it got to 3-0. Because then I thought, well, I'll probably try and watch something where a game which is not completely finished.
Okay.
And Liverpool were spectacular. I thought in terms of that four of Salah, Coutinho, Mane and Firmino as well. Just the way they combined, particularly for that third goal, I think it was, where they all passed to one another. It was just the movement there, which I thought was spectacular. I mean, I don't think Spartak actually played... I've probably seen worse performances in 7-0 defeats, and I should know as a supporter of a mediocre football side. But I think that... just the way that Liverpool go forward at the moment is such a joy to watch. It's just a question of can they keep those four players, for example, fit through this whole winter period.
When they click, they really click. Out of interest, though, Andy, how good are Spartak Moscow and how excited should Liverpool fans be?
Well, they arrived having only lost 1 in 18 after a really poor start to the season. So it's a good result, but I kind of feel that with Liverpool, of course, they are a better side than Spartak. I don't feel that we've learned anything enormously new about them. We know the potency of that four, and we know that when they get the foot on the throat early, they're pretty difficult to stop. So, of course, the way it escalated was fantastic, and no one's saying Liverpool fans shouldn't enjoy it or anything like that. But I guess the real question, and the real questions will, of course, come further in the Champions League anyway. They sort of come when they have to break through a packed defence rather than, as Archie says, score three in the first 20
minutes. Well, they beat Maribor 7-0 in October.
Yeah.
And then got hammered at Tottenham. These big scorelines do happen in the Champions League. You know, Arsenal beat Slavia Prague 7-0 in 2007. Liverpool beat Beşiktaş 8-0 in 2007. Should Liverpool fans be excited, or is this just one of the quirks of the Champions League group stages, Barry?
Well, if you can't be excited about your team winning 7-0 and playing really well and putting on a great show, there's probably not much point in watching football. I mean, because it happens so infrequently. You know, Roy Keane has been a bit grinchy about the fact that Spartak Moscow weren't up to much. I'm not sure what they could have done, to be honest, you know.
Yeah, you can't do much more than score seven in the Champions League.
No, sorry, I'm not sure what more Spartak Moscow could have done. You know, their left-back, Georgi Zhikaia. I was doing the minute-by-minute of this report, and he is one of those names that's quite difficult to spell and type. And
it's a hard life, isn't it?
When I was writing out the teams, as I do before the game, I was really hope this guy doesn't feature too prominently. He promptly gives away the first penalty and then gives Liverpool the second or third goal as well. Eventually got hooked. You know, he had an absolute nightmare. For Spartak, you know, some of their defending was appalling, but at times it was like they were being attacked by a swarm of hornets or bees, and they could have got double figures fairly easy. They missed a lot of chances. Mo Salah, took him a long, long time to get on the score sheet. I think that's why Liverpool didn't take their foot off the gas, because they were desperate for him to score as well as the other three up of their front four.
I think also the permutations in this and how that played into it, the fact that Spartak had to win to go through, they couldn't really afford to kind of just step back. They needed to get back in the game.
Exactly. You can't sit on a 3-0 down, can you? I mean, no. There's no point. If you're going out, you're going out, aren't you?
And they went out.
Yep.
I felt very sorry for their goalkeeper, Alexander Selikov, who when goal number seven went in, he was just standing on with his hands on his hips, just pondering the futility of it all. You know, we all envy professional footballers their job and their lifestyle, but I didn't envy him one bit. And at the end of the game, he just looked thoroughly fed up. And to be honest, he made two or three very good saves and didn't do a huge amount wrong. He was just left hopelessly exposed at times.
The question Liverpool fans will be asking is, bearing in mind that they absolutely weren't the best team in Europe in 2005, and yet they won it, how far can they progress in the Champions League?
Well, I always had Liverpool down at the start as an interesting dark horse. I said I thought they could go the furthest of any of the English teams. I'm not sure if I'd really stick
further
with that
Man
now.
City?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'd stick with that now. This was before any football had been played, really. So I think I would probably be more likely to say Manchester City now. And Tottenham have surprised enormously at this level. They've been absolutely fantastic. But the fact that Liverpool do have a couple of gears this season, I think is helpful. The fact that they can counter-attack, but they can really go after sides from the start as well. You know, the front three or four or however they decide to play it gives them something else.
Did they have an easy group, would you say?
I think comparison to other groups, if you look at the group, for example, that Spurs had with having to face Borussia Dortmund and Real Madrid, I think this was one of the easier ones for sure.
You think? Because I think it's easier to say that in retrospect.
Of course, that helps.
But it does, doesn't it?
But we're allowed retrospect. Yeah,
we are allowed retrospect.
The group's finished.
But I mean, as it proved, you know, it wasn't a good Dortmund side, was it? Certainly in the Champions League context. I mean, they ended up with 2 points, for goodness sakes. The lowest tally ever to get you in the Europa League. I mean, that's incredible.
That was partly, I guess, down to Spurs playing so well against them in the first leg, that helped to kind of change the momentum of Dortmund's season. But that's another thing. But I think Liverpool are a side that sides will not want to draw them, such as the way that their attacking prowess is. And actually, when Klopp reached the Champions League final with Borussia Dortmund, he didn't exactly have a world-class defence there. And the games were... I mean, that game against Malaga when they won 3-2 by scoring two goals in 69 seconds. I don't think you could say that Borussia Dortmund's defence was spectacular then. And I don't think you'd probably describe Liverpool's defence in any sort of similar terms. So I think they're one of the darkest horses for this for this Champions League.
It wasn't all sort of rainbows and unicorns for them, though, because they lost Alberto Moreno to what looks like it might be quite a serious injury, judging by his reaction when he came off. He sort of hung a leg out to block a shot from Luis Adriano. It was a bit of a pile driver, hit him on the ankle, and he went down, came off, went back on, and immediately came back off again and was in tears. So I suspect I am no doctor, Ellis, but
no.
Dr. Baz is diagnosing ligament damage.
I would love to see your bedside manner.
Let's leave that just hanging there.
Well, they're in brilliant form ahead of the Merseyside derby. There'll be more on that in part three. Group C, Chelsea 1, Atletico Madrid 1. Chelsea, the only English team who didn't go through as group winners, though they had plenty of chances to leapfrog Roma in the final 15 minutes with Morata, Batshuayi and Willian all missing chances. How costly could that be?
Well, they have three possible options now in terms of who they can draw in the last 16, which is Besiktas, Paris Saint-Germain and Barcelona. So I think Chelsea fans would probably want Besiktas out of that. But as Eden Hazard was saying after it, we are Chelsea. It doesn't matter who we draw. And I think that's the mentality that they have to take as well, because in both games against Atletico Madrid, they played very well. And particularly on Tuesday night, Eden Hazard was excellent once again. Atletico did cause them problems, but I think they're going to really... do a lot better when they have Diego Costa back, because Fernando Torres just wasn't enough of a target man in terms of being able to help them out there.
I quite liked how bullish Hazard was in the press conference he gave afterwards. Because
I've really warmed to him. Sorry for butting in. I've really warmed to him. He seems to get interviewed a lot, probably because he's always their man of the match or he's always scored. And he just comes across as a very eloquent, likable bloke with a mischievous gleam in his
eyes.
I like the cut of his jib.
My daughter's childminder thinks he's devilishly handsome as well, so that's changed my opinion on Eden Hazard. But he's the one footballer she will talk about him until the cows come home. It's his cheekbones, his beautiful stubble, the thick hair he obviously has, but he cuts it short, doesn't he? But he just... There's this slight ambiguity as to how sexy he could be, I think. But still, great player. Now, Atletico, semi-finalist last season, runners-up in two of the last four. What's gone wrong with them, Andy?
They simply weren't ambitious enough in the two games against Karabakh. I think they thought they'd pretty much have to turn up to win. And they got found out. If they'd have won those two games, it would have changed the entire group. And you know, it's strange because they've been through such a sort of different stage of emotions this season. Because if you look at it, they're still unbeaten in the league.
It's quite an indifferent domestic season for them. They draw a lot, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think the fact that they've been kind of waiting for Diego Costa has been part of that. I don't think to put yourself in a position where you think we're just hanging on for January, because of course they've got Vitolo coming in as well, is really a great mindset. I think that can make for quite a negative approach. But I don't know. There's been a sense in Madrid, particularly, that maybe their tactics were a little bit stale. It felt that way at Chelsea, I think, despite the fact that you know, they did come, I suppose, relatively close to getting the result that they wanted. But you know, it's not the draw that Chelsea that did for them. Of course, it's the fact that they couldn't get past an inferior team in Karabakh twice.
Well,
there was just one moment that I'd mentioned. You talk about Diego Costa in the press conference before the game with Antonio Conte. The final question that was asked him was, "How much pleasure would it give you if you were able to send Diego Costa into the Europa League with Atletico?" which drew kind of gasps in the press room, but also you could see the Chelsea press officer kind of smiling and kind of silently sniggering at the question, which seemed to make it all the better. And Conte very much played a forward defensive towards the question. I don't think he wanted to disrespect Atletico, but
I don't know why you'd ask that question. Costa's clearly such a nice guy. Such a you know, I think what's wrong with Diego Costa?
Does one heck of a barbecue, apparently.
Does he?
Yeah.
What the whole gamut? Everything from meat to coleslaw?
I don't know about the coleslaw. Maybe that's something he's picked up from his time in England. It'd be a shame if those 3 years were wasted, wouldn't it?
He's got corn on the cob written all over him, isn't he? Tottenham, well, they finished with more points than anyone else at the group stage. They only drew one. They drew with Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. I discussed this with Barry before we started. Should I say Santiago Bernabeu? And he scoffed.
Because I didn't scoff, because prior to that, you bet me that I was one of those people who called Barcelona's ground Camp Nou.
Yes, well...
and you were wondering why no one called Seville anymore.
Yeah, well...
apart from Christopher just and Spanish Train.
Just to defend my, as Barry put it, Neanderthal pronunciation of some of the Spanish teams, there was a Welsh language programme called Scorio on S4C in the 90s that showed Serie A and La Liga. So back then, in my formative years, it was the Nou Camp, it was the Bernabeu, and it was Seville. So, you know, maybe call me a dinosaur, if you will, but I just thought, as this is the Guardian Football Weekly and it attracts a slightly more discerning podcast listener, then I thought I'd check with Barry.
The award-winning
Guardian Football Weekly.
Thank you to everyone who voted for us in the Football Supporters Federation.
How long awards.
So we're all award-winning. We can all put that on our posters.
Yep, we can. Your next Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, yeah. Sort of an integral part of the award-winning Guardian Football Weekly podcast.
And it was sort of handed over by James Richardson, which...
Was it?
Wasn't at all sweet.
Oh,
in the shadow of Traitor's Gate.
The podcasting equivalent of sending Costa into the Europa League. How was it? Did your eyes meet across the podium?
I like to think I was reasonably magnanimous, but
I wouldn't expect anything less.
Made
you,
sure
Barry.
To get a couple of snidey little digs in.
Oh, I have seen the speech, which was put on Twitter.
The air turned blue.
You managed to not mention Max, which was quite spectacular.
I'm about to not mention him again. Yes, I forgot to mention Max, but you know that's showbiz. He's gone for a week.
That's it. I mean, it's a tough game. This Max is like Simon D. Do you know of Simon D? Does anyone else remember him? He was a very hot presenter on British television in the late 60s. He had his own show on BBC Two, I think. And he's one of the people that Austin Powers was based on. And the opening titles of his TV show, he was driven across Westminster Bridge in an open-top car with a bevy of ladies in the back seat. You know, he was wearing a suit straight from Carnaby Street, but he was so difficult to work with. By 1974, he was working as a postman. Yeah. So, think on, Max Rushton. Think on. Well, let's talk about Tottenham.
I have a feeling there won't be much mail arriving at the James household in the coming weeks. Sorry, just one reader sent me an email last night. I forgot to mention it during the Liverpool game. I thought it was really funny. It was after Mane had scored his second goal for Liverpool. He said, Mane could be on for a Salvador Dali-esque surrealist hat-trick. He scored a nonsensical scissor kick rocket for the first and effected an absurdist Rabona for his second. He just needs to convert the ball into a melting spoon to get the full set. Wow. That's from Paul Griffin.
That is why this podcast wins awards. You don't get that with a son, do you? Well, I think we should talk about Tottenham. They won 3-0 last night against Apoel Nicosia. Finished top with 16 points. It's been a fantastic Champions League group stages for them, actually.
And beating the defending champions in the fashion that they did, I think, just makes it all the better. And I think particularly how things have slipped away in the Premier League in the last few weeks, it was just an important win, this, to even with the likes of Harry Kane, for example, being rested, and Llorente Being able to go get his first goal since joining, in 7 hours or so, I think it is an important step. But I think even more so, the message that this sends in terms of Tottenham being able to finish so with such a tally of points from this sort of group. Okay, in hindsight, Borussia Dortmund did not deliver what we would expect of them in this group. And going through with 2 points is kind of impressive in terms of how bad they've managed to play in the group stage and still get through to the Europa League. But I think that with Spurs, whereas at the beginning of the tournament you probably would have questioned how far this Mauricio Pochettino side had come after the way they performed in last season's Champions League group stages, I think that this has sent out a real message, and I would put them in a similar bracket with Liverpool, if not above that, right now because of the way they played against Real Madrid, and say that they're a side that I think many will fear playing in the last 16.
So you think, Andy, that European teams will be frightened of Tottenham?
Wary, certainly. I mean, the amount they've improved since the Champions League campaign last year is absolutely mind-bending. It's unbelievable. I saw their home games. I went to their home games in the Champions League last season. And they just didn't look like they knew how to play at this level at all. So they've managed to get to this point without any practice because they didn't have a Europa League run either. Is enormous credit to Pochettino. On the other hand, it has obviously taken a lot out of them in terms of the Premier League. So how it will be, I guess, in a month or so. I mean, that's the thing. I always feel that when we're talking about conclusions for the group stage of the Champions League, the second part of it is a long way away. It's 2 months away. There's so much can change in terms of injuries. Not as much so in the Champions League in terms of the players you can bring in, because of course a lot of elite players are cup tied anyway. So what can you really do? But yeah, what they've done is absolutely hugely impressive. The win last night was kind of anecdotal because they won the group anyway. But I suppose it's nice to continue the run.
Does the slight lack of, well, recent European pedigree matter, do you think? Because they won the UEFA Cup in the early 70s, they won it again in the mid 80s, didn't they? But in recent years, they don't have the record of Man United or Chelsea. Does that matter when it gets to the last 16?
I don't think so, personally. My main concern for Tottenham would be a lack of cover, you know, thin squad, if they lose a couple of players to injury, which is quite likely in the 2 months before the knockout stages start, then they could have problems.
You see how they've struggled without Toby Alderweireld, for example. I think that more injuries to that defence, I think, would probably cause a few problems. But
I mean, if you look at Man City, they've pretty much like for like cover in every position nearly, apart from goalkeeper.
Yeah, it's unfair, isn't it?
But it is, but you know, that's what happens when you've lots and lots of money.
Yeah. They're down to the bare bones in defence, City, aren't they? I mean, I don't think they ever would have planned at the start of the season for starting games with, especially big games, with Eliakim Mangala. But that's how it's ended up.
There's some pretty lovely bare bones that they've got there.
You sound like you're at the Natural History Museum. It's a lovely set of bones. Well, Spurs could face Basel, Bayern Munich, Juventus, Sevilla, Porto or Shakhtar Donetsk in the last 16. In Group A, Man United beat CSKA Moscow 2-1. United were as good as through. Beating CSKA means they went through as winners. It was only Lukaku's second goal in 13 games. Rashford had gone 9 games without a goal. And Barry, we were talking about this the last time I was on the pod. The forgotten man, Luke Shaw, was given his first start of the season. Do you think there's still a future for him at Man United?
A week ago, I would have said no, absolutely not. In fact, I think I did say that. But he started, he played quite well. And considering how out of match practice he is, that's to be applauded. Jose singled him out for praise afterwards, which surprised me because he seems incapable of saying anything about Luke Shaw unless it's, you know, spiteful and bullying in tone.
What went wrong there?
I genuinely don't know. Paul Scholes interestingly voiced his concerns about Shaw's sort of lifestyle issues, which suggested he doesn't, you know, eat the right way, drink the right way, go to bed on time. I've absolutely no idea how Luke Shaw lives his life. He seems quite an up bloke. But
he doesn't seem
he has had weight issues, you know. So.
Yeah. He doesn't seem a prickly enough character whenever I've seen him interviewed for there to be a big personality clash.
Well, he always says the right things. Apparently is one of the two fittest players at the club. Antonio Valencia is the other. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a personality clash. We don't know what goes on behind the scenes. So,
well, United's possible opponents are Bayern Munich, Real Madrid or Roma. I mean, you don't get very much for topping your group, do you, Andy?
No, there are some years when it really matters and there are some years when it doesn't help you out at all. And like, if you look at some of the teams that have finished second, or the two finalists from last year, the obvious ones, I suppose, Real Madrid and Juventus, and you know, there are other difficult ones as well. But I suppose really the reason why that sort of leaps off the page is because it's such a steep climb for Manchester United. This has been a really easy group and a really easy re-baptism, I suppose, in the Champions League for them. So it's going to be a big step up from here. And I guess we'll get on to talking about it when we're talking about the Manchester derby. But I think there are two questions with Mourinho, particularly the fact that, A, they don't seem able to come out in the biggest, or willing to come out in the biggest games and have a go like they do in some of the other games. And B, I suppose that the last time Mourinho was in the knockout rounds of the Champions League was with Chelsea, and he was tactically outwitted by Laurent Blanc, who's like no one's idea of an intelligent tactician.
He doesn't get tactically outwitted very often, though, does he?
Well, that's what I'm saying. When was he last in the back end of the Champions League? It's a long time ago now. It's a couple of years ago now, and he has to reprove himself at that level, I think.
What do you think, Archie?
I think that there's still this aura that follows Jose Mourinho about that is perhaps a little bit misleading from time to time, particularly in terms of you see the way that Manchester United play their football. I don't think it's the most progressive way of playing football in some of the big games, even against Arsenal last weekend. I mean, I think the circumstances of that game, for example, dictate it a little bit differently because Manchester United scored twice so early. Therefore, they can sit that deep and invite pressure onto themselves, which changes it. But I wouldn't put him amongst. I wouldn't say he's the best coach in Europe right now by a long shot.
Who is the best coach in Europe?
I'd say that guy's across the city.
I thought you were going to say across from me. I thought you were saying that I was the best coach in Europe. I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, I love football. Yeah, sure. You say Pep Guardiola is the best coach in Europe?
I would, yes.
Because, all right, then let's go around the table. Barry, who do you think is the best coach in Europe?
I'd have to go Pep as well.
He does improve players, dramatically. So I'd
say. My only issue is that he's never managed a team that has anything other than very good players. So how would he get on if you put him in charge of Sunderland?
That is
probably very well, but
yeah,
you don't know because it's never happened.
Pretty much every high-spec coach in modern football, though, couldn't you?
Not necessarily, you know.
Because they'll never get the opportunity to manage below a certain level, almost, unless they completely stuff a job.
Yeah, at a certain level and work their way up, and then, you know.
He didn't start at Burton Albion.
No, he didn't.
But he did start in charge of a Barcelona side that was a total mess, that finished third, which had finished an absolute mile off the top. He started in a position where he had good players, but he had to get rid of some of them in the shape of Deco and Ronaldinho because they were disruptive influences. So I think the idea that he's like received some sort of coaching silver spoon, I think, is incorrect.
I think you're taking what I said slightly out of context there. I'm just saying he's never managed a team that has anything other than very good players. And I'd like to see how he would get on managing a team that doesn't have very good players. I'm nitpicking, but it is something to be considered,
sure.
I think.
He really likes his players to express themselves and show initiative. So I don't think he's a particularly, from what I understand, a particularly prescriptive coach in the way that some people are.
To an extent, I think that if anything, he's trying to micromanage almost every detail and every run that that his players make. I remember, I mean, you look at, it now even extends to the opposition if you look at what happened with Nathan Redmond as well.
I did like Philippe Auclair's description of that, where he said, when Guardiola kimmicht Nathan Redmond, that's turned into a verb.
Because when Pep Guardiola was at Bayern Munich, Joshua Kimmich, their right back, after a 0-0 draw against Borussia Dortmund, and Kimmich having played really quite well, it looked like a father-son dressing down that Guardiola gave to Kimmich on the pitch.
I mean, he looked terrified, didn't he?
I would be too, given the intensity that Pep Guardiola has.
He wears Stone Island. It looks absolutely terrifying.
I think that's it. The combination of Stone Island and the just brazen invasion of personal space. Yeah. It's just too much.
And that's all for part one. In part two, we'll wrap up the rest of the Champions League and ask what that means for the Europa League. And most importantly, we'll be announcing our first winner in our Toshiba Big Draw competition. We've had some incredible entries. Myself and the panel will be picking one of those drawings of the podcast for that Toshiba HD TV. Welcome back to part two, but before we get into this section of the show, it's time to pick our Toshiba Big Draw winner, just to bring you up to speed on what this is about. Over the next 3 weeks, we are giving away three super-duper 55-inch 4K HD Toshiba TVs, just in time for Christmas. To win one, we asked you to do a Max Rushton-style stick drawing of the pod, and you responded brilliantly. Thank you very much for that. We had an incredible range of entries, but one winner needs to be picked out of this week's efforts. So I'm going to go across to this podcast's resident Brian Sewell, Barry Glendenning. Glendo, Barry, did you do art at school? Have you got any qualifications?
I didn't, no. But I used
you know
to
what
watch,
you like. You know what you like.
Yeah.
And you like
if
what you know.
If you don't know what it is, it must be art. And I sent pictures in to Tony Hart.
Did you?
Oh, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. But I never got on telly. So that's how bad at art
an
I was.
Absolute travesty. Yeah, he put some right nonsense on in the gallery. But who's the winner, Barry?
The winner, there are stick men involved, so I'm going to allow this. It's Kieran Dowd, who's drawn a wonderful nativity scene featuring you as a sheep, Ellis, Andy as a
lovely
Frisian
stuff.
Cow.
Actually, most of my family are dairy farmers, yeah. So it would have been better and
sheep.
More accurate if I'd been a Frisian cow than a sheep, actually, because I don't come from sheep farming country. I come from dairy farming country, actually.
Well, look, someone else drew me in an entry with a knobbly stick and a pig under my arm.
Well,
and another entry came very close to winning, but they made my face a little bit too jowly for my liking.
Yeah.
And that's why I did it. That cost you a telly, mate.
The thing with your jowls, they're very fine margins, aren't they? You need to get Barry's jowls spot on. Yeah. Not jowly enough, and it's an inaccurate
representation.
No,
not jowly enough is fine. Too jowly.
But two jollies.
And this one also features a stick AC Jimbo as King Herod and producer Ben as his whip-wielding sidekick standing on a nearby cliff over the nativity scene with Jimbo shouting, "Kill them all."
Great.
We've got Paolo, Philippe, Barney as the three wise men on camels. And Jonathan Wilson is a horse with an arrow pointing to his orthopedic hooves. So well done, Kieran Dowd, and enjoy your new telly.
I would have preferred to have been John the Baptist, just playing a kind of holding role, biblically. But
we will endeavour to get this up on the blog, on the website, so
yes.
People can view it for themselves. It's very amusing.
It really is worth seeing. I bring big news from Europe, from Ukraine. No one says the Ukraine anymore, do they? All of my references are out of date. But Shakhtar Donetsk have beaten Man City 2-1. Man City's season, the wheels have come off. This is it. Could they go down in the Premier League? I mean, what a performance. Barry, what did you think of it? Barry, what did you think?
I'm very pleased for Shakhtar. They're ostensibly homeless. Their fans have sort of a 600-kilometre round trip to the Metalist, or what was formerly the stadium of Metalist Kharkiv, who no longer exist. And, you know, they're a good side. Lots of Brazilians there. And they've kind of flown under the radar. I don't think anyone expected them to come out of that group. Napoli have gone out. I think most people were expecting them to go through. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether City won or not. They were already through as group winners.
Well, they were on a 28-game unbeaten run, Man City. Do you think it will affect their league form?
No.
No, not at all. Does anyone think this will have a bearing on their Premier League form? Andy?
No, I don't. But what I do think is, as Barry was saying, Shakhtar deserve an enormous amount of credit to come out of a group like that. And it all goes back to when they beat Napoli on the first day. I think City, even despite the fact that, as Barry says, it doesn't matter, they would have liked to win it. And I think they, like Napoli, underestimated Shakhtar a little bit. I mean, Shakhtar have got incredible European pedigree, but you know, so much has changed for them with them being displaced over the last couple of years. You know, 4 years without a home game is absolutely incredible. And it's a lot of credit, not just to the players, but to the current coach, Paulo Fonseca, the masked man.
Their second goal, by the way, a 23-pass move was pretty handy as well.
Liquid.
Does Edison get an assist for it? That is the question.
But I can understand why Edison pulls out of the challenge to...
Yeah, that's I don't need to win this game.
I don't need
it?
To win this because if I tackle him, I get sent off in a suspension. So, yes, exactly. But Fonseca, yeah.
The Shakhtar Donetsk coach, Paulo Fonseca, he kept his promise and after reaching the Champions League knockout phase, attended the press conference in a Zorro outfit. I don't know if any of you saw this. He said he'd do it at the start of the season. He did it. I personally can't imagine Mick McCarthy doing that.
It's worth underlining that he promised to do it at the start of the season, isn't it? Because after recent headlines, you could perhaps make the argument that he was simply trying to disguise himself to bat off unwanted attention from Everton.
Yeah. Well, Steve
and
Evans...
Munich, by the looks of it, as well.
Steve Evans, the... Rotherham coach, he said at the start of the season, if they survived in the Championship with a game to spare, he'd go to the last game in dressed in sombrero and shorts. He did that.
I think it's a little bit unfair on Paulo Fonseca to mention Steve Evans in the same breath.
Well, you know, obviously it adds a lovely bit of colour, doesn't it, to a press conference, the fact that Fonseca was dressed as Zorro.
Steve Evans doesn't need to dress up to add colour to his press conferences.
However, so I was initially very impressed with it, and then I remembered I used to read Shoot magazine in the late 80s, and they always used to go very big on the Liverpool Christmas party, which tended to be fancy dress. And, you know, I remember Glenn Hussein, Bruce Grobler dressed as Zorro. It has been done. It reminded me of the fact that Liverpool and Forest used to play a pressing game in Europe in the late 70s, but we've had it sold back to us by Johnny Foreigner. This Zorro thing. Man City's possible opponents are Basel, Bayern Munich, Juventus, Sevilla, Porto and Real Madrid. On to Group B, Celtic lost to Anderlecht, but they still qualify for the Europa League, which Brendan Rodgers insisted from the start was their aim, but they only did so because they had a better head-to-head record versus Anderlecht, who were level on points. Does this show, do you think, that they'll struggle to make an impact on the Europa League, Barry?
Celtic?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. They're you know, same old thing we say about them after every round, nearly. They're too good for their own league and not good enough to compete with European teams.
What do you think, Andy?
Well, I think we should be taking less from what happened against Anderlecht and more, I guess, a look at the Europa League overall. It's just the other teams, isn't it? As Barry was saying, just the quality elsewhere in the Europa League is such. And, you know, I think we always start to feel it more at this point of the season when a few biggies have dropped out of the Champions League. That's why they're going to struggle to cope. I'm not sure if there's anything they're doing wrong particularly, but there's just a massive gap.
He seemed very deflated, Brendan Rodgers, when he spoke after the game. You know, he's admitted that it was always their intention was just get through to the Europa League stages, but they did it with a whimper rather than with a bang.
They're through, and I think that actually in the home game against Bayern Munich, they showed that they can cause problems to Europe's elite. I mean, Bayern Munich weren't at their best that night, but I think that that's something to take forward. But you just look at the other names in the Europa League draw, and I mean, even the likes of Atletico Madrid, Borussia Dortmund, I think Leipzig, Napoli as well, you would put in that category. I can't see Celtic going deep into the Europa League by any means, but I think that it's still an achievement for Celtic to to actually seal third spot in this group?
Well, the teams joining the Europa League are Atletico Madrid, Sporting Lisbon, Celtic, of course, CSKA Moscow, Spartak Moscow, Leipzig and Napoli. Bayern 3, PSG 1. Bayern needed to win by 4 goals to leapfrog PSG, so they're to make 2 for second. Tell us more about this win, Archie. Does it prove that Paris Saint-Germain aren't quite the runaway favourites people had them down as?
I think, again, you put this slightly down to circumstance, but I think such is the way of Paris Saint-Germain. They don't want to lose any game. And I think after the collapse against Barcelona earlier this year, I think every game against the big side in Europe has really taken on that extra level. But I think that for Bayern Munich, this was very much about themselves putting out a statement after the embarrassment that they suffered in Paris earlier in September under Carlo Ancelotti, which was, of course, his final game. And some players who had perhaps not come up trumps for Bayern before set new standards. Corentin Tolisso, for example, had an outstanding game. And I think maybe it helped as a former Lyon player. If he needed any extra motivation playing against PSG, it was certainly there.
He enjoyed that.
So if you look at some of his celebrations for his goal, then you can see that he enjoyed that. But Kingsley Coman as well, who six months ago it was not in the best position at Bayern Munich, and there were considerations about whether or about this sealing his permanent transfer from Juventus, but he's really kicked on and now looks like somebody who could step into the rather large shoes which are there from Franck Ribéry and Arjen Robben. But if you listen to what Bayern were saying before the game in terms of we want to make a statement and what they're saying after it, that this was showing the real Bayern Munich once again, then I think that they're very happy with it, but I still think that there are steps to go.
Why have the German teams fared so poorly in the Champions League this season?
Not just the Champions League, also in the Europa League.
So what's going on there then?
You've got, I think you've got, there's a boring answer, which is it's down to lots of different reasons. In terms of you look at Bayern Munich starting the season, for example, even with Carlo Ancelotti, because I think second place for them is not great. But below that, I don't think it's helped, for example, how the German clubs have had to sell their best players to the Premier League over the past few seasons so consistently. I've got a list here where, I mean, next season Naby Keita will go to Liverpool, for example, but you look at how Henrik Mkhitaryan went from Borussia Dortmund, Ilkay Gundogan, Granit Xhaka, Leroy Sané, Kevin De Bruyne, Heung-Min Son and Roberto Firmino. These were key players in Bundesliga sides. And I think that continual loss will eventually catch up with you. But you've also got squads which are quite thin, which have not been able to cope in terms of in the Europa League. Leipzig, They're talking about how it's been a case of maturing at this level. They've not got all that much experience, perhaps on a similar level with Tottenham in terms of the quality is certainly there in that side, but it's just about kind of having that know-how of how to play at this level. Whereas for Borussia Dortmund, I think that this is just not... I don't think Peter Bosz has been the coach that they were hoping for, particularly in the big games. Every single big game this season, Borussia Dortmund have fallen short. And you have to put that's down to a number of circumstances, but I think that Peter Bosz's tactical inflexibility earlier in the competition has ultimately come back to bite them, as well as their fitness, because they seem to just collapse in second halves of games.
Okay. Barcelona 2, Sporting 0. And sure, the Barcelona remained unbeaten.
And I suppose it's been fairly comfortable for them. They had a bit of a going over in the away game at Sporting, but apart from that, they controlled both games against Juventus. So it's good for them. I think there's still a feeling that they've been playing pretty close to the maximum of what they're capable of in current form at the moment. Of course, you've got to temper that with the fact that Ousmane Dembélé is yet to come back. But I think Barcelona can be lightly pleased with what's happened so far in Champions League and Liga aside. I think if you're looking at them in Champions League terms, they'll be higher up people's betting rank than they were at the start of the season, because I guess a lot of people looked at them at the start of the season and thought it could all fall apart. But Ernesto Valverde, probably because so much other stuff has been going on in the club, around the club, in Catalonia in general, he's been able to get his head down and just get on with putting his print on the team rather than being analysed too closely.
They're top of the league, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think Barry shares my view on the idea of Barcelona being a club in crisis. Newport County in 1988 were a club in crisis. when they were wound up in the High Court and had all of this stuff auctioned off, covered by the South Wales Argus. Barcelona club in crisis.
It's comparative, naturally.
It is comparative. I just find it such an absurd way to... What do you think, Baz?
Well, it is all relative, I suppose, but yeah, it's kind of crisis.
Have you watched very much Barcelona this season?
I've seen a fair bit, yeah. They seem to be doing up motoring along okay to me.
I think they'll probably be all right. Yeah. Are Celtic a club in crisis? No, I don't think so.
No. I think nearly 70 games unbeaten at domestic level, is that now? Or in the Scottish
But Premier? Is it enough for Celtics fans? A mere 70 games unbeaten. 70 games unbeaten, is that right?
It's not quite 70
68
yet.
Or something. 68, yeah.
Oh, right. Well then, come back to me when it's 70.
Nothing's ever enough, I find, in football at the moment.
Yes, you're quite right. In Group G, Beşiktaş are confirmed winners. They won two. Well, they were before they won 2-1 at RB Leipzig going to the Europa League. Porto beat Monaco 5-2, double sending off. One of my favourite things in football. I love a bit of silliness.
You say that though, don't you have that feeling that in a situation like this, where it was a push in the face versus a clip round the ear, if you're the player, you've got to be walking off the pitch, not thinking, oh no, I'm suspended, but if I was going to get sent off, I might as well have got full value for my swipe.
You may as well do a Norman Hunter and Franny Lee if you're going to get sent off, I always think. Really get stuck in.
Properly kicking out time on Saturday night.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But you see, these days you get added ban for that kind of tomfoolery.
I think there's always room in the game for characters.
What was the Newcastle one with... Was it Lee Bowyer
and Kieran Dyer?
That was spectacular.
I think it was the fact that Bowyer came off with a slightly ripped shirt, didn't he?
Yeah. It looks sexy. And then Graeme Le Saux and David Batty, they got sent off for fighting in Europe for Blackburn Rovers in about 93.
There was one at Preston last season. Two players got sent off for fighting with each other.
Wasn't it? Yeah. I think, yeah.
On the same side?
Yeah.
These were both players from different sides in Porto versus Monaco. We have to point that out.
Just to put it into some context, I love it when players fight, players are on the same team, have a go at each other, because it shows they care. I love that.
Although one of them doesn't care.
That's well, yes, that's
and
true.
And the other cares too much.
Yeah, it's just a game. If anything, I think FIFA should accept that this is what supporters want to see, and you should win points for it. Can you imagine that? I think
some sort of trophy at the end of the season. You're saying?
Or? No, not a trophy. I think it should be like bonus points in rugby.
Okay.
Each match would just be conducted with like a cartoon fist fight with boots and fists coming out of a cloud, one on either side of the pitch. And
yeah, but...
Where do you stand on power moves like wedgies?
Well, I just think that in general, the Premier League experience has been sanitised. And I think we need to bring back...
Cripples and wedges.
Yeah, make it slightly more agricultural.
To be fair, at corners, that kind of stuff would happen anyway. It is, I remember.
Yeah, so let's codify it. Let's make sure that it happens only in set pieces. Then, free kicks and corners is like the Wild West, but for the rest of the time, football should carry on.
Stefan Lichtsteiner would be licking his lips at this prospect, given the way that he was man marking. I remember in that Champions League tie at Celtic a few years ago.
Fond of a cuddle, it is fair to say,
is a diplomatic way of putting it.
Do you think he could handle himself?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, well, he's straight in my scrappers 11.
Yeah.
Champions League draw is 11 a.m. on Monday. We haven't mentioned Arsenal yet. They're already in the Europa League, but they face Bate Borisov tonight. The draw for the next round of the Europa League follows the Champions League draw on Monday. That's the end of part two. We'll be back for part three, where we look ahead to the weekend's Premier League fixtures. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's look ahead now to the weekend's games. Two biggest games are on Sunday, Liverpool versus Everton and the Manchester Derby at Old Trafford. We'll start there. Man City, obviously, the fact that the wheels have come off this season, notwithstanding, are 8 points clear at the top. How do you see this one going, Barry?
I think Manchester City will win. I'm not so sure Jose Mourinho will park the bus in the manner many suspect he will, purely because... Well, it's interesting, because if Manchester United, despite beating Arsenal last week, if they play like that again, they will get absolutely slaughtered by City. And, you know, if they park the bus, you could still see them getting slaughtered by City. But I was just looking at the bookmakers' odds. You know, City are odds against in a league match for this game.
And yeah,
I really fancy them to win it. But in the interest of having a more competitive league this season, I'd kind of like Manchester United to win. Well, I would if it wasn't for their manager, who I really don't like at all. And I want only bad things to happen to him.
Jose?
Yeah.
Is that a recent thing,
Well, I used to think
it's classic Glendening grudge.
I used to think he was just sort of a pantomime villain, and that in real life he was probably okay. And then after the manner in which he treated Dr. Eva Carneiro during his last stint at Chelsea, that made me think, nah, he's just a nasty bully, and I don't like bullies.
I initially loved him when he came to the Premier League all those years ago. He really freshened it up, the special one and all that stuff. The fact he looked so tired all of the time as well, and yet his teams were so successful. But I think you're right. He
probably has many endearing qualities. He just hides them well.
I wonder what Jose Mourinho's endearing qualities are. I bet he always replies the texts.
Well, I remember Chris Kamara is good friends with him, and you know,
is he? An unlikely friendship that is. What do they talk about?
I'm not sure, but I interviewed Chris Kamara once, and he showed me a text conversation he'd had with Jose, and he came across as quite friendly in that. Now, maybe Chris Kamara is just a fantasist who makes up, gets
it's
someone
actually
else.
His wife in his phone,
but he has her in as Jose Mourinho.
There are fake text apps out there. So it's possible.
But are they?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Now, me saying that now makes you go, why do you know that?
What's your previous? Do you think...
I did hear a good anecdote once. It wasn't a particularly good anecdote. But Jose was just mentioning he'd been in an English pub. He said he'd been in a pub for the first time because his wife had run out of cigarettes and he went out to buy her fags in the pub.
From the machine?
Presumably.
You only get 16.
I know. And they cost more.
Yeah.
If ever there's a sign that footballers and football coaches were paid too much, then that is it, isn't it?
But I thought that was quite nice, running out in the cold winter night to buy Mrs.
Buy his
Marino
wife's fags.
But he went into the pub and he said he'd never been in a pub before. And I was thinking, how the hell do you get to whatever age, early 40s, without ever having set foot in a pub?
Yeah, I suppose he couldn't stay for a pint because his wife would have been absolutely gasping.
Going up the wall.
This mercy dash to the local. And if only he'd walked another few hundred yards, he'd be able to get a cheaper packet of fags, from the newsagent. Yeah. But no, when his wife needs cigarettes, his wife needs cigarettes. How do you see this one going, Andy?
I think maybe United can prize a draw out of it. Unlike Barry, I do think United will play very defensively. Because they tend to in these biggest games, and B, because I would imagine the way Mourinho looks at it is, well, we can't win the league this weekend, but we can definitely lose it this weekend. Because of how good they are at beating up chumps, specifically this season, if I was Manchester United, I would take a point and think I can chip away at that lead for the next however many months. I don't think there's any need for them to be brave in this game. There's certainly no compulsion for them to be so. And I don't know, it's one of those situations that makes me look at it and think, I really wish, for all the entertainment of the Premier League, I wish it was like other big European leagues, in the sense that I don't think goal difference should decide between places. I think it should be head to head because that affects the way that teams attack these big games.
Okay, well, Liverpool are playing Everton at Anfield on Sunday as well. Everton are winless in 17 successive Premier League visits to Anfield, drawn 8, lost 9. Their last win at Everton, their last win at Anfield was in 1999. So to put that into some perspective, if on the way to the game, for that game, if on the way to the ground, you know, people would have been discussing the Millennium Bug. If you'd said to your friend, I think that within the next year or so, Tony Blair is going to be booed and jeered by the Women's Institute National Conference at Wembley, your mate would have assumed you were recounting some sort of hashish-inspired dream. That is how long ago it was that Everton were at Anfield. So how do you see this one going, Barry?
If Liverpool play as well as they did against Spartak Moscow, I would worry for Everton. I presume Sam Allardyce will have, you know, he's not even travelling for the Europa League match.
No.
That's the disdain with which
he's making a risotto.
Yeah.
But he'd already bought the ingredients, got them from Ocado. It's an Ocado delivery, which is quite expensive.
So he's presumably staying at Finch Farm with his defence, whipping them into shape. I have to fancy Liverpool, but, you know, it's a derby. Form goes out the window, Ellis. Except in those derbies, it doesn't.
Well, they've been pulled out of the hat together in the FA Cup, so they're going to face each other in the FA Cup third round. Everton's record in the FA Cup is better against Liverpool than it is in the league. They beat Liverpool in the FA Cup in 2009. Does anyone remember the goal scorer?
No.
Oh, jeez.
You just want a moment to think about these things, you know. When Everton beat them?
In 2009. I've just realised that I haven't written it down, even though I watched it on YouTube yesterday. So
is it slightly left field?
It was something like David Gosling, but I think I've
Dan Gosling.
Dan Gosling.
That was when the TV feed cut, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. The TV feed cut on ITV. If you were an ITV viewer and not at the ground, you'd have missed the goal because ITV went to an advert for Tic Tacs. To put that into some perspective, 2009, Barry Glendening was the enfant terrible of the Guardian sports desk before your defeat under the table, Barry. In 2009, we were the Guardian. I'm trying to put a Liverpool-Everton games in perspective.
Right.
2009, Paul McInnes, regular on this podcast, was still destroying the careers of up-and-coming hopeful stand-up comics with his poison pen. Before he was a football writer, it was when he was destroying dreams, but that's fine. West Ham are hosting Chelsea. They pushed Man City very close last weekend, and Chelsea playing midweek. So, could we see an upset here? Do you think?
I think the parameters were slightly different away to Manchester City, where there was just absolutely no expectations. But I think that such is the way that West Ham have played this season. That changes immediately as soon as they go back to the London Stadium, and there is an expectation to be able to give something. And even against a Chelsea side who are vastly superior to them, I think that there is so much anger around West Ham right now in terms of the way that the club has gone that it's difficult to really foresee anything apart from an away win. What will be interesting is who starts in goal for West Ham, because after the way that Adrian played last Sunday against Manchester City, you would think that he would overtake Joe Hart in the pecking order, because Joe Hart's been out of form, as Barry was saying on Monday's pod. He's not really looked that same person since Pirlo Panenka'd it down the middle against him. And, I mean, even in terms of the England pecking order, I think Jordan Pickford should be certainly above him after his recent performances. So I think it's not looking great for West Ham. And you would look at other games this weekend, for example, Huddersfield and Brighton and some other sides, you would think, okay, are they going to be in the relegation mix-up? But such is the way West Ham are going and some of the games they've got before Christmas, I don't think it looks particularly bright for them right now.
Spurs are up against Stoke. This is, I think, an extraordinary story. This is the Mark Clattenburg thing. Now, Mark, he made comments to NBC, which have attracted a lot of attention. He was referring to the Battle of the Bridge game where Spurs needed to beat Chelsea to stay in the title race 2 seasons ago. He said, if you haven't heard it, I think it's amazing. I allowed Spurs to self-destruct so all the media, all the people in the world went, Tottenham lost the title. If I sent 3 players off from Tottenham, what are the headlines? Clattenburg cost Tottenham the title. It was pure theatre that Tottenham self-destructed against Chelsea and Leicester won the Premier League. I helped the game. I certainly benefited the game by my style of refereeing. Now, he goes on, some referees would have played the by the book. Spurs would have been down 7 or 8 players and probably lost, and they would have been looking for an excuse. But I didn't give them an excuse because my game plan was let them lose the title. Now, he was deemed the best referee in England.
By himself, if you listen to the podcast.
So what do you think of these? Is he bringing the game into disrepute?
The greater problem I have is the way that he very much talks up this whole thing just in terms of his terms. And I guess it depends on how you want to see your referee. But personally, I think it should be about the players, not the referee trying to make the headlines. And I think this is just completely what he's seeking here. It does bring the game into disrepute in that I think from a referee's point of view, there is a certain amount of game management that needs to be done. You do accept that. But to purposefully not make certain decisions because you're trying to protect your own back, that doesn't sound right.
Well, he said, I think we're all part of the theatre. That's why the Premier League is the best in the world. We've all got a duty to make sure the game's enhanced.
Well, his duty is to
officiate,
punish people according to the laws of the game. And if he's choosing not to send off players who should be sent off, then that's wrong. I mean, on the other hand, he was a good referee and was famously very pleased with himself. It doesn't concern me insofar as he's not refereeing here anymore, so it doesn't matter. But I worry for the referees of Saudi Arabia. And I worry, is that how every referee thinks? No, surely not.
To me, it sounds like someone who's trying to make himself look like the puppet master and just making excuses for a crappy performance,
to be fair, which is what it was.
I think he's writing this after the fact.
Clattenburg's a fantasist.
In his book, Jeff Winter, the former referee, he had that famous passage where I think it was during his final season, he was refereeing at Anfield and a ripple of applause washed across the cop, and he decided it was for him.
For his record in the game.
Because this
knowledgeable crowd.
Yeah, this
Liverpool.
Knowledgeable crowd.
Yeah, they know their football at Anfield.
They knew it was going to be his last game and they wanted to pay tribute to his magnificence. You know, it seems to be a similar level of delusion. You know, you're the ref. Until you mess up, no one cares what you do.
It's a massive game down at the bottom of the Premier League. Swansea hosting West Brom, who are fourth from bottom. The Swans could go a point behind them with a win or find themselves 7 points adrift by Saturday night. Now, we've had a question in from Here We Go. Ellis, on a previous Guardian Weekly, you stated that Swansea fans are more or less resigned to relegation. Yes, that's true. But surely the thought that at the same time as Swansea go down, there is a good chance that your dreaded rivals Cardiff City get promoted, who they are currently comfortably second, that should be enough to rally both supporters and for the team to try harder. Well, you'd think. But our fans have given up and the team don't seem to care, so...
Wasn't there a dressing room skirmish in the wake of their defeat against Stoke? Have you heard anything about that?
I have. I just read about it in the papers. If you ask me, it's come 10 games too late. The idea that the dressing room was quite a chilled out place of where you know...
Paul Oakenfold's soundtrack, pre-match...
Yeah, they were just blissing out.
Or lying on beanbags.
It's more like a breakout zone at The Guardian. You know, everyone just sits on a beanbag and just discusses what could happen. What usually happens is we lose by an odd goal and we get rooted to the bottom of the table. Yes, well, Cardiff are doing wonderfully well under Neil Warnock in the Championship. And if somehow this side stays up, I can't see us doing very well against Cardiff next year. Maybe that's just because I am, by my very nature, a pessimist, and I get I get criticised for this every time I talk about the Swans on a public forum. People say, oh, you're too pessimistic. But Neil Warnock, they are a real team of fighters, that Cardiff City team. You know, they're a classic Warnock team, really, in that they just never quit. Whereas
your power stance at the beginning has now changed to something which is much more forlorn.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I'm now covering my groin, whereas before it was open for everyone to see. I don't know. I mean, apparently Clement's place at the club is assured until January at the very least.
I admired his honesty in the wake of the defeat against Stoke. He, you know, didn't beat around the bush. It sort of said, well, we're fine from Monday to Friday, but Saturday we're not delivering. We deserve to be bottom. No excuses.
Yeah, I just don't know. I do another football podcast with Danny Gabaldon and Iwan Roberts. And the one thing I've learned from that is how sensitive footballers are. And I don't know whether this playing squad would appreciate Clement saying those sorts of things. Because whilst he is right, and it is clear for all to see that the team aren't good enough, players don't like to be talked of in those terms in public. So he just looks, I think he looks like a beaten man.
Would you accept Tony Pulis out of interest?
I am in the minority, and I would. But I would say that's a minority position with Swansea supporters. We would like our team to play proper football. There's some big games in the Championship this weekend. Sheffield United are hosting Bristol City tomorrow night. Both third in the league, only separated by Bristol City's greater goal difference. Top versus second bottom as Wolves take on Sunderland, Barry. How do you think Sunderland will fare?
I think they'll get hammered.
OK. That'll do. Hull have appointed Nigel Atkins on an 18-month contract. Hull are currently 3 points above the relegation zone.
I think Nigel Atkins, after what happened with him at Reading and indeed at Sheffield United, this is a very big moment in terms of his managerial career, because the success that he had, I think, at Southampton originally in terms of taking them back up into the Premier League, and indeed before that in terms of building his reputation at Scunthorpe, there is ever greater distance growing between those relative successes, and they were certainly. So he needs to get this right at Hull, otherwise he's going to be in a difficult position and having to search a little bit lower, I think, for his next job.
I'm just going to move on to this because, oh dear, dear, this upset me. The much maligned Checker Trade Trophy continued this week. In a game between Scunthorpe and Leicester, Leicester fielded an under-21 side with 6 overage players, 3 internationals and transfer fees worth around £45 million. Now, you've got to ask, what is the point of the competition if teams are going to do things like that?
Well, the competition is a disaster, you know.
Yeah.
It was revamped with the sole intention, according to Sean Harvey of the Football League, to give young English players a chance. They're not getting the chances, clearly. And yeah, it's a mess. They've ruined it.
It's a shame because Swansea won it in 94 and in 2006, and they were brilliant days. They were great days out. And it's a pity that you can discredit a competition like the Football League Trophy, because I think lower league clubs deserve a day out at Wembley. So for a team like Scunthorpe to play Leicester, who are playing 6 overage players and, you know, transfer fees worth almost £50 million, it's a shame.
But if Sean Harvey was in this room, I would imagine he'd defend it to the hilt and claim it's a huge success.
Well, I'd like to get Sean Harvey in here. Get him to defend it.
I wouldn't fancy your chances. He's complained a few times about things we've said about him on this pod.
Has he? In which case, Sean, all the best.
Well, sorry. To be quite specific, he certainly complained once. I was summoned to explain myself.
Were you?
Yeah.
You can't quieten me. I'm Barry Glendening. I'm the enfant terrible of the Guardian Sports Desk.
Only in your head.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks very much to Archie, Barry and Andy on Monday's show. Paul McInnes hosts with Priya Ramesh and Daniel Harris. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.